Good morning. I'd like to call the Finance and Administration Committee meeting to order. We have before us an agenda with seven action items and two informational items. So we are going to try and manage time here as well as move forward with the work that we have to do. Are there any questions about the agenda? I want to call your attention to the fact that there is a blue sheet to one item there which represents the changes from the mail-out package. I'm hearing no objections. We'll move forward with the agenda as approved. The minutes are available. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
No move.
Moved by Mr. Downs. Is there a second? Second by Ms. Hines. Any questions? Hearing no questions, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, hearing none. The first item is the approval to hold a compact public hearings on the proposed service reductions and budget for FY 2012. And this is a follow-on from prior Finance Committee meeting as well as the special meeting that was held to provide the docket information. Ms. Kissel, if you will do the presentation.
Yes, I'll take the committee through this. As you indicated, Mrs. Hudgens, this is really, the purpose of this is to present the committee consideration for public hearing and to receive public input in the format that we're recommending and in with the list of service modifications that the board, the committee had spoken about last Thursday. So if you go to the next chart, and this is just as a reminder and background, because I know we do have some new board members here.
It's me. I apologize. Yes. I wanted to welcome Mr. Barnes to this meeting. He is sitting today, and he'll be participating, and welcome. I just forgot that we were upstairs and didn't do this publicly, but anyway, glad to have you.
Okay, thank you. So it's again, we have a $1.46 billion operating budget, and general manager submitted a budget in January which had $74 million worth of budget cost reductions in it. General manager had requested a $72 million increase in subsidy levels from the prior year, and the three components that make up that subsidy increase, or the drivers of it, are primarily two of the primary ones are one-time cost closure measures that were implemented last year, the $30 million preventative maintenance to shore up our operating budget, as well as a carryover of a loss that was experienced in FY 2010 that is being carried over into this budget. So those two make up about $46.7 million of that $72 million. The other larger piece is the slower than expected growth in revenue that we anticipate having in FY 2012. And as a result of that, that's about $24 million. As you can see here, we've made a very strong effort to keep operating costs relatively flat year to year. And the increase on operating costs is at $2 million. So, and then as a side note, not as a side note, actually, it's a very large capital budget this year, larger than any that we've had in most recent history. We have a capital budget to implement for next year of $851 million. So the under that context, there has been many discussions about closing the $72 million gap, if you will, whether it's closed by subsidy increase. We've also recommended or have provided other one-time options for the board to consider, and they're listed here. At last Thursday's meeting, the board provided staff with direction on a docket to go out to public hearing to receive input from the public in two ways, one being a town hall information and then other more formalized meeting which talks about these service recommendations on the next chart. for consideration by the public. And as you can see here, they're listed. I won't read them one by one, but they're a series of bus route reductions. There's also, on rail side, there's widening headways. And then on the district had proposed a, what we call a buy down, where there is actually a 50-cent discount originating at Anacostia Bus Garage, which the district would like to transfer that discount to promote bus to rail transfers and rail to bus transfers throughout that region. And they're listed there, the particular routes that would actually be impacted by that change. And the last bullet really just talks about the fact that the discount for this particular item is going to be maintained. It's just going to be benefiting riders who are actually transferring from bus to rail and rail to bus. And so that's those are the items that we are going to get direction from the committee here today, based upon last Thursday's meeting, to put together a more formal docket.
So what we have on slide 9 is the items that set the boundary of changes that we can make in service, and they've been identified and discussed with the jurisdictions that have provided them and the impact. Let me make sure that we have questions, because we were electronic the other time, so we have before us Mr. Marcel Acosta.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, what is the overall cost savings of this the service changes in this particular docket?
For bus, I'll give you the annual numbers because, just as a reminder, because we're a little bit behind schedule for a variety of reasons, we would most likely recommend an implementation if there were any changes to occur in September. So from an annual basis, bus is a little over $1 million, about $1.1 million, and I believe rail is about $6 million, the way they're listed here on the chart, on an annual basis.
Okay. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair?
Ms. Hines.
I just want to verify my understanding. What we would be doing then is this becomes the maximum change that we could make. So, for instance, when you look at the rail widenings, we could choose anything between 13 minutes and 18 minutes and below 25 minutes on the late, or we could change the hour that the late change might go into effect. All of that is possible inside the scope of the advertisement. Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair, I don't know the process you want to take in terms of modifications or of how you want to change what could be on the docket at this time, but I am going to want to include modification to routes 70, 71, V7, and V8.
Okay, so this is our last shot, and so that you're in, I think it's appropriate today that we can insert any additional ones for that advertising. So if you'll take us to where you are, 70?
Yes, modifications to Route 70, 71, V7, and V8, how much specification do you want?
I think staff will be able to do those. Those were part of your list of previously, is that correct? Or these addition?
Well, I think they were, I thought they were previously
on the larger list. At
right.
Least. Okay. Staff just needs to know the route and what is the action that they're
We've got starting. It. We'll add it to the docket.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And those are the only ones. Okay. All right. Any other questions? So this sets the service impact that we are putting out for public hearing, and it sets the boundaries of those. So anything that is not on this chart actually will not happen in any manner.
And that's correct.
What is on this chart may or may not happen. That's the boundaries we're working under. Okay.
Which leads me to the public involvement on the next page. At the request of the chair, Mrs. Hudgens, and the board, there was a strong sentiment to get more public involvement than just a formal public hearing, which is public involvement, but to some extent a public hearing affords the public to comment, and typically it's more of a one-way street. The board, people who sign up to comment would speak for 2 minutes, and then there would be recorded, and then the staff report would consolidate those, that information provided back to the committee. In order to create more of a dialogue with the public, the board chair and the board here wanted to understand how we can get more of a dialogue with the public. And as a result, we're recommending a town hall on the same evening of the public hearings in such a way that it would provide that dialogue. Typically, we have booths that are set up at public hearings. The bus folks are there, the rail folks are there, all of our subject matter experts are there that can answer any question about any bus route or any rail route or any bus priority corridor network or bus stop, and that happens typically at a public hearing. But actually, we'll look at more dialogue to happen before that public hearing, an hour before possibly, to have a presentation by the staff which gives a broader picture of what Metro is about, what some of the challenges are, and describing that in more detail, and then have more of a dialogue from the public in that regard. And that's how we intend to set up the public hearings and town hall meetings, two per jurisdiction, I believe, was the recommendation here that we're providing, and that a board member from the committee would be facilitating each one of those town hall meetings as you see fit. And then staff would be there in full force, and then we would put together a staff report that would subsequently be delivered to the committee sometime, I believe, at the end of May, hopefully as a result of that hearing and town hall. In addition, I'll just make one other comment, and it's on the next page. We do intend to even go beyond that and look at public involvement to get public involvement for those who cannot attend any of the six town hall meetings or public hearings, and we would do that on an online survey in order to gather as much information as we can. We've done that in the past. It's worked very successfully and has provided us with a lot more information for the board to consider as they look at these changes. So.
I just wanted to comment that the opportunity for our public to provide as much input, but also for us to provide as much information about the budget process is very important. The public hearing is the legal requirement that we have, but that would limit us to primarily slide 9. But there's much more to say about our budget, and I think our writers advisory and our other customers have been engaged, and we want all of our customers to be engaged and understand what this budget consists of, why we're here, what our have been the challenges, how are we looking at moving forward, just so that they can be as informed as possible and allowing them to opine on those issues that we might raise or information as well as the public hearing legal requirement. Okay. Mr. Downs.
In that context of the town hall discussion, I would hope that our information to the public, particularly with respect to options that have been suggested, is balanced in terms of both they are options, but they have negative consequences, and we need those to be understood.
Thank you.
We will definitely do that.
I think this town hall format is a really good idea, and I've had a lot of experience with this sort of open house information tables things, and it works really well, and I think it gives people an opportunity. Some people are sort of unwilling to sit through and stand up and speak in a formal public hearing. The other thing, the one thing that I would add is I think it would be a good idea to give people little comment slips or comment pages. If they could only come for the open house, or if they choose not to stand up in public and say something, they can write their comments, and then we can take them as written comments. And I would say that oftentimes those are very thoughtful comments from people who have thought about this, but maybe can't stay for the public hearing or whatever.
Madam Chair? I'm really glad we're going to use an online tool. It's hard for people sometimes to get to the meeting and all of that. I'm wondering what format the information takes that precedes giving comment when you're in this online situation. I think since a big part of our purpose is to educate people before we ask them for their opinion, I would hate for us to have an online survey that didn't also try to educate, whether it's that you all have taped your presentation and it's there, or there's bullets or something. But I want to make sure we use every opportunity to educate.
What we're planning to do is provide really the story of the budget in short up front, because it is limited in terms of how much attention that you can get people to get through a series of questions. But also we would be putting it on our website, and we're also going to do a fair amount of public outreach so we can point people to the website and other places to get information in general. So we'll do a lot of outreach on the town halls and public hearings. We will be doing, of course, we do the required legal public notices, but we'll also do display ads. We will do some e-alerts. We'll send out alerts to our various lists that we have. We'll put up banners in the station, so we'll create awareness about this and encourage people to also go to the website to get informed. But the actual instrument of the survey will have background in it, and we're just now, you know, based upon the input that you are providing in the conversations, putting together the outline and how you would begin, how it's envisioned is we would have tables of various topics where folks could come in and ask information of staff, then probably for about 20 minutes. Then we would have a PowerPoint, if you will, and take those who want to participate through some key questions. I know one issue that's come up before is how have we funded our budget previously? So do we want to continue to use those sorts of options going forward, or are there others? And, you know, just educational as well. Where does Metro receive its funds from? You know, it's embarked right now on the largest capital program in the history of the building. So those are the kinds of things, and we'll put it together in an outline form so that we have it together in a logical flow. And then we're hopeful to, you know, pose questions and perhaps have a survey that people can check off as they go along, so we get, you know, a lot of the feedback and take Q&A. And then we'll go into, after that process, we plan to go into the formal receiving of comments on the legal public docket that's required. So that's what we have in mind for the process.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm still trying to keep up with on the docket. That for clarification to staff, I wanted to be sure that on the routes that I was talking about, that it would also, just for full information, envision establishing a new Route 74. And I think staff may know that, but I just wanted to make it clear. And it may not have to be on the docket because when you establish a new route, but it mm-hmm. certainly is full information for our folks. And then, Madam Chair, any discussion about the matter that we discussed?
Sure, go right ahead.
As many people know, that there was a letter went out by Transit First, which is a multi-jurisdictional representative group, that asked that we at least consider the possibility of increasing parking fees by a dollar at the parking lots or garages where they're currently 100% full on average. And I just wanted to put that out there, and did not know if my colleagues had received the same letter, and if really, I'll defer to you, Madam Chair, but at least if it's not on the docket, if there's a public acknowledgement and discussion of the board's thinking about this.
Thank you for acknowledging Ms. Eveline and Transit for First Transit Coalition information. And I think there's a question that needs to be asked in terms of One, the letter can be inserted as public information, but the consideration of the information provided, is it a requirement for the docket?
It would be considered a tariff increase, and so you would have to put it out to public hearing, and it would have to be on the docket, yes.
Okay. And that opens the discussion, and I was going to bring that to the end, but let's go back to it now. That opens the discussion of whether or not we then wish to add an opportunity to consider parking. And I would ask my colleagues, does everybody have the letter? You've seen the letter. I think it was sent out to us. I know I received it directly from Ms. Aveline.
Then, if I could add, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Simply that it's not intended to offset our subsidies, but it was intended that if we're going to consider lengthening the times between trains, and that we were going to, if we were going to put on the docket impacting service, that also to have the option of there, is there a way to buy back some of that service or prevent some of the service changes? That, so I just wanted to be clear what the two issues were. It wasn't just the $1 increase at the 100% full parking garages, but it was a strategy or a possibility for trying to mitigate impact to service. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Discussion?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. I appreciate the letter coming in, too. I think the more information we can get, the better from every constituency and every group. I would not want to see this go forward as a consideration at the moment on to add that to the parking. I think there are a lot of implications to that we have not examined. I know that there are parking, ridership, they are all sensitive to manipulations and structure. And I think the important thing that we as a board have committed to do is to find a way to create the most efficient budget that we can for this term. We recognize that it won't be a perfect solution and that we've committed that we're going to take a strategic look at the long term and how we manage this and what the implication of each of these changes will be on the overall system health and ridership. And but for this particular issue, I support the receiving the recommendation. I'm happy that we received that. I would not want to bring that consideration of that dollar fare increase in the parking forward for this year. I would, and in the context of the headway, I mean, we've made no decision on that. I think it's an option that was thought, that was brought forward as a possibility. I know certainly from my vantage point, I have no predisposition to looking at immediately changing headways. We'll get the data that comes in, but we want to fully understand the implications of that. So to make a long story shorter, I wouldn't want to do that. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nichols. Any other comments? Well, Ms. Hines, I'm sorry, I didn't see your hand. Go ahead.
Yeah. I guess I appreciate the sentiment in which the district offers this as an offset to the subsidy change that could come for rail. And as the person who said, let's put the widenings on the docket so we can have the conversation, quite honestly, I'd be happy to take the widenings off the docket. The implications for that in Arlington are tremendous. I suggested we put it on so we could have the conversation and understand. But I do think as we start adding these pieces and we as a relatively new board with people who are only beginning to understand the relationship between these things, I am reluctant, and I've been reluctant the whole way through, to throw a whole lot of things on the table. Where I think we are relative to this budget is, as Ms. Kissel said, we've got about almost $47 million of what is basically a structural problem, things that got kicked down the road. And as I have said before, we are prepared to pay our full subsidy and would prefer to do that to these other things in Arlington. So, you know, I'd rather, if we're going to have true angst about this, I'd rather just take the widening off and say, let's all pay our subsidy. That would be a pretty clear message.
I agree.
Thank you. Welcome, welcome brevity. Wow. I love that. You've just gotten a cheerleading. I don't know if there are any other comments. Just quickly, I think one part about the parking is that most of what we've put on, it's been about either very strictly jurisdictional or equity across the system. And I think in the parking, it deserves a lot more discussion as to how we get there. So are we discussing this. So is there a need for anything to be said in action other than I want to make sure that we acknowledge the work of Transit First, because I think this is the kind of engagement we want from our public, and we don't want it to look as though we are not accepting it, but that we really want to have it as part of a larger discussion of budget implications. Yes.
Could I ask if anybody has a sense of what the revenue potential of such a measure would be? Vis-a-vis the $6 million that the headways would save
yeah,
us.
Yeah, I don't have that numbers in front of me. What I do have in front of me is utilization rates at the parking lots where they would be at 100%. And I will tell you that they change on a month-to-month basis. So 1 month you can be, and there's only probably about six or seven that are at 100%, 100 utilize or up to that level, 95 to 100. And sometimes they're at 100, sometimes they'd be at 94. So you'd have to actually look at some of the criteria that you'd want to set before you did that. Do you do it every month? Is it real true congestion pricing that you're trying to effectuate? What's really the goal, the outcome? So that would be have to be discussed and really thoughtfully laid out for you, us to you, before that was done. In terms of revenue, I mean, I'm just going to make a wild guess that it could possibly be, maybe it's a few million dollars, and that's probably high.
But not even six.
Yeah, right, exactly. So.
And if I understand that the last time it went down rather than up.
So. Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. Any further discussion about the letter? Okay. Thank you very much. So that brings us to actually what we're here to do. We've heard the discussion about communication. Is there any more information about the communication? We have a calendar in front of us, and the calendar describes where we're moving forward. Ms. Kissel, do I have a motion? And we are recommending this to go to the board, which will be our special meeting, so that we will have today and make this an action item from the board as well. So is there a motion?
I'll move.
Second.
Mr. Nichols moves, and the motion includes the amendments made by Mr. Wells to the docket. And is there a second?
I second.
Mr. Costa is seconding, and that is we will move to the board with the docket as proposed and the resolution contained in our packet.
Any further?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Just to make sure that it includes the district's recommendations today. So what was on the PowerPoint, including the routes that you described, will be on the docket. Okay, I just want to make sure that's in there.
That was my reiteration. Okay, for any discussion? All those in favor of the motion to move this forward, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none. Station, and this item is coming forward on capacity improvements for Union Station. Mr. Bodenheimer.
Hi, thank you very much. And let's see, can we start off with the PowerPoint presentation and go to the current layout slide? Just start off with the PowerPoint, and then we'll go to the video. So, and just a cursor forward to, here we go. Okay, thank you. All right, so this is a pretty straightforward item to approve the amendment of our budgets to permit the District of Columbia to pay for design and environmental work that would allow us to basically put forward a design-build contract that would position us to be essentially shovel-ready in the event that there were any federal or other funds available for construction of a full build of improvements to the Union Station North entrance. But because this is our highest ridership station, because the ridership of the station is so regionally balanced, it's a and because you know so much of the so much growth that we're expecting to see from commuter rail and an Amtrak growth in the future, I just wanted to take a few extra minutes to go through what this project would be because of its regional implications. And so the first thing I wanted to do is just to orient everyone here to the location and the improvements that we're planning on making. This is to the north. This is First Street Northeast, and so the Capitol is down in this direction. And so what we see right now are the current entrance here, which is one of our locations where we have a lot of conflict. People come in here and they go up the concourse to Amtrak. We see a lot of queuing on the platform waiting to go up the two escalators here, the up escalator and down escalator. And what I'd like to show you first is a video that is a representation of the kind of congestion that we see in this right now with current ridership with this configuration. So if we can switch to this. This is going to be all video and no text images, so hopefully that will be a good precedent. So what you see here are the escalators up to Amtrak Concourse. Yes, so look at that. Is that the red one running away? Okay. Obviously, people don't move through the station this quickly, but it shows, it gives you an idea of how queuing occurs behind the escalators. What you'll see is a gap, and then you'll see a lot of dots coming up. That represents a train coming in on the platform. So what we are planning on doing, and if we could switch back to the PowerPoint presentation and go to the full build slide. To address a lot of these issues, we want to relocate the doorway that goes out onto First Street Northeast. And almost there. So we want to relocate the current doorway up to here and widen it so that we don't have this weird movement here, and use the space that currently is used as the exit ramp and add more fare gates there to reduce queuing behind that. We'd like to replace the elevator to the platform that is currently here and add in a set of stairs to increase the capacity to move from the platform up to the mezzanine. And we want to introduce a little walkway and put the station elevator further down the platform. Two other really important additions here. One is opening up a tunnel that would extend up to 8th Street that would make a direct connection to development that's going in, at the Burnham Place development. It's forecast for the future over the rail yards, and also to make a connection to the streetcar network that the district is building. And then really, sorry, can we move back to that slide? And really critically is to add an additional set of stairs or escalators up to the Amtrak concourse. These would come out, if any of you are familiar with Union Station, in between the B. Dalton bookstore and the post office that's there. And that, and so there were issues we'd obviously have to work through with Amtrak, but we're working closely with the USRC and them to do this. But the reason that this is so important is that really the fastest component of growth for this North Station entrance is from the development that's occurring in NoMa all along here, and it's going up to the Amtrak concourse. So we really need to get that capacity there as well. If we could just flip back to the video that represents how this set of improvements would perform with the level of ridership that we would expect to see in 2030. And you can recall the queuing that you saw with the first video, and you see how relatively smoothly this all now works with a lot more people there. So fewer conflicts. You don't see any of the paths crossing over one another. You don't see the congestion or the queuing up behind it. And I guess one of the other points, sort of the meta points I would make about this tool is that this modeling, this pedestrian modeling technology or analysis tool is a lot like the traffic simulations a lot of people would see in local governments when you're trying to demonstrate that a retail project or some other kind of project is not going to overload an intersection. You're just taking that analogy and moving it into the pedestrian movement environment. And in the traffic simulation where a truck or a bus have a different way of moving and affecting things around it in the traffic simulation, here we have people who are carrying luggage, and they're represented by the bigger dots, and they obviously move more slowly, and people require more of a space around them. And then the color of the dots also, for us, it's interesting because it shows where people are coming from and where they're going to. So whether they're starting at Amtrak and going down to the platform, and whether they're going northbound or southbound on the platform. But we're going to be applying this kind of analysis tool to other core capacity stations so that as we get the same kind of passenger congestion and safety issues that we expect to see with ridership growth, we'll be able to test different scenarios for how to make the platform safer, more comfortable for patrons, improve evacuation capacity, all those kinds of things that are really important parts of the core capacity and of the system and its safe functioning. So we can move back to the PowerPoint presentation. And let's just flip forward to benefits slide. So we've talked a little about the benefits, again, safety, capacity, accessibility. We've used a tool to calculate a travel time savings, which is, of course, interesting, and we think it saves about 133,000 person hours annually, which is a significant benefit from a planning and customer point of view. And we'll move on to funding and implementation. Basically, a number of different options for funding it. We can visit those during the time period when we're doing the planning and design work. So maybe that's better handled in Q&A. And that basically wraps it up. So recommendation, we're requesting approval to approve the reimbursable project, establishing a project budget. You can see that on the screen.
We can read that.
Yes.
Let me first raise questions. Mr. Giancola, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, I want to just say that I'm a daily user of this station, and he's understating the problem. In fact, I am in one of these photos.
I think
in the photo on the Metro Rail platform. That's me with the bald head on the left side of the platform, watching all these people on the right-hand side. But it's actually more than that. I certainly want to make or express my support for this project as a user of Union Station. When you see walls of people coming off the Amtrak, MART trains, and I'm the only one going in the other direction, it's pretty frightening. And so I just want to support it, but also point out to you that it's no longer a Dalton's bookstore, it's a Barnes & Noble now.
Okay. Mr. Wells, is there another question?
My question is, looking ahead, one of the things that may take the longest period of time is dealing with Amtrak. What is the interaction and role of Amtrak? Do we cross real estate that they have control of, and then have there been any discussions? Because, again, I don't really have any idea how one gets Amtrak to engage in a discussion like this.
So it would require the relocation of the elevator to the platform would require taking out some space from an Amtrak loading dock right now. And again, there's the retail space that we described before. But we've been working closely with the USRC and with Amtrak. We actually met with a consultant to Amtrak's planning organization just a couple days ago. And we were, they are trying to figure out how to carve out space for the ridership growth that they expect to see on high-speed rail.
Maybe you can tell Mr. Wells of the URC, who's made up of the URC.
It's Union Station Revitalization Corporation, which is an organization that has membership from or board membership from the USDOT, Amtrak, the District of Columbia. Yeah. and it manages Union Station. So we've been working closely with them, and it'll be hard, I think. I think you're right that there are going to be negotiation issues, but we're working with them. So I think we have the prospect of it. I don't think it's infeasible.
Okay. We don't have a motion on the floor. Are there questions to staff before we do so?
I think it's important to explain the difference between elevator platform and the connector to the light rail system through the utility tunnel. And I think Member Wells' question was to both, and the status of the negotiations about the access from the Metro rail station to the light rail system through the utility tunnel.
Okay, I may not have fully understood the question.
You have two separate issues with Amtrak. One is
right.
The elevator access.
That's right.
The other is the access that you pointed to going north.
Okay, so the three issues, and I guess the issue with the platform elevator is if we're going to relocate the elevator from its current location and build a little hallway, we would need to take room for a loading dock. That's one issue. And that's to get from the Farragate level down to the platform. To get from the Farragate level up to the Amtrak concourse is the second issue, which has to do with the retail space. And the third issue, which I think is the one you want me to add, is the issue of the tunnel that is extending north to 8th Street to make a connection to the streetcar and to the development to the north. From a construction point of view, there is 75 feet of dirt that we would need to excavate. There's a second issue, which is, I guess, Amtrak's rights to use the area below the 8th Street Hopscotch Bridge for its own platform capacity in the future. That is an additional point of negotiation. The connection to 8th Street helps us on the station capacity. I think the other two are much more critical in terms of getting people from the Amtrak concourse down to the mezzanine level and from the mezzanine to the platform. That's correct. Furthest along in our discussions. I think best answer to that would be we would use the design process that's funded now to address those questions, and I would be in a better position to answer that question after we had moved through this design process. What we've represented to you is the results of conceptual planning that sets the stage for this, but it's not a designed, environmentally tested plan.
Just a quick question for purposes of clarity, just define what a reimbursable project is and means in the context of the decision that we are the action that we'll take.
Reimbursable project, by our board policy and guidance, is a project that is specific to a jurisdiction, and an agreement is made between the jurisdiction and the NWMATA relative to what the scope is and what the funding is. Before WMATA would start on that project, advance funds would have to be put in place and committed to in order for us to start on the project. It would still have to come before the board as a whole, as it is now in this committee, to describe what the project is, and the board as a whole would have to vote on it. That's the process.
Just one follow-on to that. So the funding for that comes from the jurisdiction funds the design project that we are approving right now, and
yes.
it's a metro project, but it is funded by the jurisdiction, and that's the agreement that would be executed between the district and WMATA, correct?
At this point, it's funded by the jurisdiction, this phase of it.
Okay.
If
correct.
It goes into any other phase, it would have to be brought through our CIP capital program, and it could be funded if the decision was made to have it as part of our capital program.
I understand. Okay, I just want that clarity. Thank you.
Ms. Porter?
I was just going to suggest, and I know you're not there yet, but to put the suggestion on the record that when you're redoing the station, that you look very seriously at signage, both interior signage for the station and exterior to show people where the station is. I used to be a daily user of this station. I'm only an occasional user anymore, but many times coming out of the First Street entrance exit, you encounter puzzled families of tourists walking up and down First Street looking for the entrance, and they may be standing right next to it, but there's nothing that indicates it's an entrance. And if you look at it from the street, it doesn't look like any place you'd want to go. So I really, and there has been a problem, I mean, the signage has been improved over the years, but it's still terrible. People get confused between Amtrak and Metro. They get confused between which level goes where. Something needs to be done about signage in that station.
I just want to clarify, where this is right now is you're asking for funding for the design phase, the environmental documentation, preliminary engineering and design, and that is a DC project at this point in time.
Right. We're not requesting funding here. The district has said there are grants right. and local match necessary to support the federal grants, so it is a district-funded project.
At this point. But at some future point, the board could be asked to consider making this a regional reimbursable, putting it fully in the CIP, or it could stay as a district project. And that is that full range of choice is available to us regardless of how we move forward, how this first phase is funded.
That's exactly right.
And I guess at some point, since we're doing a very large project in Arlington right now, that's pretty much all our dime, I would like to understand how we think about what things are eligible for, what sorts of funding as we move forward. I'd like to understand that better.
Talk through that a little bit. Right now, this is really just asking for setting up a reimbursable project and that framework, if you will. But
Mr. Downs.
You'll see a paragraph that is stricken about the 5-cent surcharge. There was some jurisdiction concerns about the use of the nickel surcharge for funding this station project. And we actually withdrew the request for the authority to proceed with that, pending some further jurisdictional discussion about all of our expectations about a surcharge, its use, and the processes for making those decisions. It needs more transparency, but it needs also more understanding about intent and use. And I would respectfully request that the board have that discussion at a future board meeting after the staff has had the opportunity to put together a presentation about their understanding and then have it also be considered by the JCC.
That's a request for information, and we will certainly address that. Mr. Downey.
Yeah. Just to be sure of what we're doing today, as I understand it, it is authorizing at district expense the design and environmental work that would lead to a design build contract. But a decision to go forward on a design build contract would be a future decision. And would have to have a funding source associated with it, and would have to explain what the implications of any funding source are vis-a-vis other capital commitments. So we will have that chance to say, what does this good project do for the system, and how can we pay for it relative to other needs? And then one just fact question. In terms of relationships with Amtrak, I dimly recall when I was on the Amtrak board and the USRC board, that they required WMATA to pay rent in order to deliver WMATA customers into the station. I just wonder if that's still the case. You can let me know later. I thought it was dumb then. I think it's dumber now.
Dumb, dumber, and dumber. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Is there a motion on the table? There's still a question, okay.
Yeah, it would be also useful. I don't think you have this information now, but just for information purposes, to know how many riders use the Union Station embark or arrive and depart, and what jurisdictions they're from.
Yeah, it is.
It's on page 32.
Okay. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Mr. Koska, second. Is there a second? Well, I will second it. Mr. Wells? Okay. Seconding the motion. Further discussion? I would just like to say this is really a very good news story, and we've had a lot of discussion about how might it be funded. And I think the question in mind is how do we provide the kinds of improvements that are needed ongoing at our stations, and we continue to grow. And so this is one that's coming out. We clearly are moving forward in saying that we are developing a project and that it is a reimbursable project. It will be brought back to this board based upon what comes out of the design build offering that the staff will be examining. So with that in mind, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? I don't know, are we asleep or not? Okay, that moves forward. Thank you. The approval of a design build agreement for the Cinder Bed Road and Bus Garage.
And I'll have Mr.
this
John
one is
Thomas.
Another one. We're revisiting this, and so there's this is to move forward with what we have had as a prior discussion, and I think we can go through quickly.
Okay. I'll have Mr. John Thomas go through this quickly.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Pleasure to be here today to talk to you about our Cinder Bed Road Bus Garage. We have a presentation. There we go. We're here to ask for a committee recommendation to go to the board to enter into a design-build contract and award that contract for the Cinder Bed Road Bus Garage and enter into agreements with utility companies. It's a very long story. We'll see if we can tell it shortly. Unsolicited proposal was received in August of 2008 for land, design and construction services, and financing. We issued, as policy is, a solicitation to see if anybody could match that. There were no responses. We entered into a master development agreement with the proposer that eventually led to us buying the piece of property. We closed on that property on April 1st, and the master development agreement brought to the table the design and construction team. We have reached agreement in principle on that contract. A couple of terms that we wanted to bring to your attention is that this gives us a bus garage with a capacity of up to 160 buses. We have set a guaranteed maximum price of $48.2 million. And within the contract, we have audit provisions, specifically the general contractors, general conditions, bond, and insurance are all audited. There's any work that they self-perform is audited, and all subcontract work we're requiring that be bid out. If they do not get at least two bids, that subcontract work also gets audited. Then we would have occupancy within 22 months after notice to proceed, which we would plan to give in May. One of the things, going back to the audit, a little bit of history, we use this exact same approach for a reimbursable project for the expansion of the Navy Yard West entrance in anticipation of larger crowds going to the baseball stadium. And when we did that, it turned out to be very successful. We came in under budget and were able to actually return funds to the District of Columbia. They were the funding source for that. And the last item on this bullet is we have to get agreements with utilities for the services that we need to bring to the garage. Next slide. And the recommendation is that we award the design build contract. The contractor is Tompkins Builder out of the District of Columbia for the Cinder Bed Road Bus Garage. And then a recommendation to enter into agreements with utility companies for services.
And questions, Mr. Downs?
I should probably know this. Is this inclusive of a LPG facility?
Yes, there are CNG accommodations. What we've decided to do from a strategy standpoint is, since we're planning to build three new bus garages, almost back to back to back, we're going to procure the CNG equipment as a standalone contract so we can make sure it's the same equipment in all three garages. But the contract has the accommodations that have to be built into the garage.
In other words, the gas pipeline?
The gas pipeline and like the detectors and those things that are specific to a CNG garage.
Okay. Is that Mr. Nichols?
Just trying to get understand exactly what we're doing in a larger context. We received an unsolicited proposal to execute this work, and because we received the unsolicited proposal, we decided it was a project that we should consider doing. And I don't mean my question to be facetious, but how does that, was it already in our capital program as a project that was scheduled to be accomplished, or did it get on the capital budget program as a result of the unsolicited proposal?
It was the latter. That we got the unsolicited proposal almost 3 years now ago, so it was before this, the capital program had been established. So when it became a viable project, we did an evaluation of the site, and we had a public hearing on the property and the garage there. It was then eventually added into the capital program.
And that's because the conditions it needed to be. And so do we have I presume there are other facilities that are in similar condition or that would fall into the same bucket, or did we reprogram to get to this facility, or what are the trade-offs we make to make the execution? Help me understand.
As I understand it, there was an evaluation, there was a capital needs inventory that was developed, and this was one of the projects that went
help.
On it.
So the first answer is we do a 10-year CNI, our needs, capital needs inventory. This was in our 10-year CNI, bus replacing of bus garages. We have a couple of 100-year-old bus garages around. So this, we were always looking to replace. So it just got moved forward because of the opportunity that revealed itself in the unsolicited proposal and the availability of a tract of land that was actually targeted as a good use for that facility. And so it got assessed in terms of the return and the investment, went through our prioritization process that we do every fall when we look at what capital project meets the goals of the authority on a list of criteria. And that's how it got funded.
And a little bit of background, the existing garage is probably about 70 years old. It's sitting on one square block in the city of Alexandria. So it's very, very undersized, a little over 2 acres. We have about 80 buses there. But since the building is so old, we also cannot bring any of our new technology buses in there. So we have to send our older buses to this facility as well. And over the years, it's now grown up where there's nothing but houses immediately across the street from us. So it's out used its useful life, and it can't accommodate any of our new technology buses. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't allow for any growth either.
And just to add to that, one of the difficulties when you're trying to build a new bus garage is find a location for it. So this is a rare opportunity where someone came forward and said, we've got a location, we're willing to work with you on it, and we took advantage of it.
Okay, I guess
I just wanted to try and put it in the concept where we sit on the other side of that aisle. We have always had part of our capital needs to replace the Royal Street garage, and that the ability to do that has been difficult, as you described. We have a land site that is in a corridor that serves the bus area that the Royal Street is serving, as well as being able to expand services beyond that area, such as further to the Franconia area, the like. So this is meeting our capital need, and it's also, as Mr. Searles indicates, finding the right place that has a desirable need of wanting to do it there. And this has gone through the approval process of the jurisdiction, and it's now coming to us to move forward. So we're meeting both our capital needs as well as the opportunity to find a partner that can provide this improvement at the same time.
Okay, well, I really am not questioning the capital requirement, the need, or the fact that it's there. So please don't misunderstand my question. And it may be probably me coming up to speed in terms of understanding our capital budget and our capital program and our process and our priorities. I'm just trying to understand what moves the project forward to execution, what's the process, and how we establish the priorities for that. And certainly they're probably already set. I just need to understand what they are. And as we move forward on the process, I'll really want to understand that from a fiscal standpoint, priority standpoint, impact standpoint, because there are probably a dozen garages and other stuff that's got to be fixed too. I'm just trying to understand how we set those. Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
And in that presentation, could you also identify the number of times the board has already acted to support this project?
Over the last 10 years.
Not that way.
And with that in mind, do we have a motion?
Yes.
No, it's good.
Okay, is there a second?
Question.
Okay, discussion. Mr. Yule.
Yes, the cost, the design build cost is at $48.2 million.
Yes, sir.
But was there a line item somewhere in the budget or some document I remember reading that has an amount much greater than that?
The capital budget, this is CIP 86, I do believe, is certainly greater than that number. So this is a subset of the project budget.
Okay, so it's not, the 48.2 is a subset of the 101 million, approximately.
Correct.
But the balance of the 101 million is to be used for other projects.
Yes, there's other project costs, but then there's going to be a reprogramming opportunity with some of that money.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you very much. Staff positions for the capital program, and this is a discussion that is regarding our moving forward with the auditor and the purchasing to move these projects in our capital need that we've developed much more quickly and providing the kind of staff assets that are needed.
And let me just, I'm going to spend a moment not going through the slides, but giving you the framework and the context for which we're coming forward on this. I don't need to tell you that our capital program has increased by over 100% from where we were last year to where we are this year, and then in the coming five-year period. So we're looking at staring down the hole at a $100 billion program, really, if you include reimbursable projects and all the ancillary projects that we do. As Mr. Sorrells has indicated, we're staffing up to do that. And as we do that, we are cognizant of three things. One is our PMO, Parsons Brinkerhoff, who is here, helping us stand up the program to manage it and to deliver it, is assessing. And in their assessment, they have made assessments where we require infrastructure in order to deliver the program. So it's coming to you within this context. This is an up to 30 people, and it's going to be up to 30 because we think it could be less than that as we sort of populate the resource deployed where we need it most importantly. And there's two areas where we need it. We need it in the area of procurement, and in line with procurement, we need it in the area of the Inspector General. That might seem odd, but what happens here at Metro is our Inspector General has resources that look at contracts, if they're sole source, which are very minimal. As you know, we solicit competitive solicitations for every contract that we can, and the last course resource would be exception basis would be sole source. And they look at things like cost pricing analysis, and they validate what procurement has done. It really acts as a check and balance. So among those two areas, and I call that whole area procurement because it really is procurement. Right now, if you look at our procurement cycles, we can be anywhere of 6 months, and we can be anywhere to something like 120 or 180 days. That is not best practice. That prevents, Mr. Kubitschek and parties from getting their investment out the door and getting projects delivered on time as planned. So in order to for us to lay that infrastructure, we are requesting this resource up to 30, and as I said, we would deploy it not all at once. We would deploy it over time as we need be in order to get our program running. The third point that I'll make to you is we work very diligently with our HR group. We have a policy or a procedure in place under our personnel manual that says as we hire capital hires, capital term employees we call them, the guideline is that they are hired on the basis that as there is money, you are, you know, employed gainfully. And when projects run out of funding, then you're at risk of being terminated. That's a policy and a procedure that we have under our manual. And I've always made the statement that hopefully we do not terminate those employees, because as we train and invest in the intellectual knowledge at Metro, they're doing one project, we want to shift them over to another project. And that's typically what's done in a large capital program such as the one that now we have inherited. So just a broad context of what we're requesting here in order to deliver our capital program. And we can go through the slides, but I just wanted to give you that big picture. And if you have any questions, that might be more productive going forward.
Let me entertain any questions.
Make one point that Mr. Sarles just made. Thank you. It's we are looking to supplant some of the contractors that we have in place now with employees, right? So that's always more effective and more efficient. And as we evaluate that and do that, it makes a lot of sense to keep that knowledge base within Metro.
Right. Yeah. Mr. Downey.
The budget for this is already incorporated in the capital plan. We're not trading off any work for these jobs. This was already funded in the overhead element of the capital program.
It's funded within the $850 million for FY12 that you see, yes.
And the goal in the capital program is indeed to step up the pace of work, use the funds we have available, get the results, and this is a bottleneck to achieving that.
Yes.
And then just for my background, I understand the FTA requirement for cost price analysis. That is a standard requirement. I think it's unique here to have the Inspector General doing it. I'm not suggesting that should change, but I would like to know how it's done elsewhere.
Yeah, I agree with you, and actually we do have an ongoing assessment to look at that with experts that we have on staff now through PB, and they're looking at that now. I will tell you that a lot of other transits do it within the procurement area. It is not outside of that.
Right, which might free up IG resources for other higher priority issues.
That's correct.
I can answer that, anticipating that's a possible question. I belong to the APTA audit professional staff, and I surveyed our membership, and a number of at least 50%, more than 50% of our members, it is done by the audit function. But let me clarify that audit function. Some transit authorities have an auditor general or internal audit staff. And this function on contract attestation can be done by them. It can also be done by the external auditor that does the financial statement. There are three other transit agencies that have an inspector general. I am the only one that does it, and that's mainly because two other agencies, LA Metropolitan Transit Agency and New York MTA, they have an auditor general office that does it, so the IG does not do it. CTA, Chicago Transit Authority, the IG does not do it, and they do not have an internal audit. They don't have an office of auditor general, so procurement does it.
But the federal requirement is that it be done, not specifically how it be done.
Okay. Mr. Nichols.
Thank you. Just two questions, and it's terrific that we're moving the capital program ahead. I really appreciate that. Two questions. We're hiring up to 30 term employees, and I think I understood this part. They're chargeback the cost is charged back to the projects, and the definition, term employee means they're essentially contract employees that the hire may be terminated at any time without obligation further. Is that correct?
They're not contract employees. They would be WMATA employees, but they would be funded with capital programs. And the nuance is that if capital funds ran out on a particular project that they were dedicated to, then they would be at risk of losing their position at Metro.
So they're full-time employees?
Yes, full-time employees.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah, that's right. An important distinction. I did not understand it that way.
Right.
Okay, with
right.
full benefits and full, your regular employees, it's just that the cost is charged.
And
back
it's
to
a
the
challenge.
Well, let me just address that. One of my concerns when we entered into accelerating the capital program is if we had to get PB in this case in to get us up to speed fast. But with that, they gain the institutional knowledge. And if we're going to have a capital program that is at a pretty high level, at least for the next 5 or 6 years, I want to make sure that we actually bring that institutional knowledge in-house. A, it costs us less, and we maintain it, and I have to continue to pay the consultants to provide it to us. So that's the reason that we're looking at hiring a certain amount of employees to help us, because we expect them to be around a while and to continue to move from one project to another.
Okay. And they're part of the capital budget and not the operating
Correct.
Budget.
Correct.
And final question, Madam Chair. How many employees are on staff right now that provide this function? I just want to get a sense of what 30 is. 30, is it 30 plus 30 or is it 60 plus 30? Just right. to give me a sense of context.
So in our FY12 budget, we are looking at a capital funded positions to drive a almost $1 billion program of about 1,000 positions.
So there are about 1,000 there now, and we're looking at
1,000 for FY12. That's what
for
we're planning.
FY12.
So we've got to ramp up to that.
And what the request we're considering today is to add 30 to the 1,000. Is
that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and that number changes. I mean, it's an up to planned number, right? So that's where we have to kind of be in order to, and that number will change. You'll have vacancies. You won't have those are not filled positions right now. They're positions that we're planning to ramp up to by FY12.
I guess the last question in that context, the 30 positions that we're adding, are the other 1,000 positions similar in terms of at risk should projects go away?
Yes, they are. They're
okay,
all
so
at
they're
risk.
All the same category.
They're all positions in the field, they're program manager positions, they're track, they're all sorts of positions at all various levels in order to implement a capital program, because you have different requirements. So they're all different types of skill sets and resources that you have to deploy to do that.
No, I understand. I appreciate that. I'm just trying to make sure I got a sense of the numbers that we're talking about. And so it's 1,000 positions, but not all of our occupied. Is that what you're
saying? Right, that's correct. And when you look at it in our January budget book, which I have here, which hopefully will be final in June, we have that chart in there that looks at the amount of operating positions and capital. And I think it says about 1,000. But since January, since that was published, and then today, right now, that 30 is not in there. So we would be updating that when we get to a final budget form in June.
Last question, I'm sorry. How many of those 1,000 are filled right now?
That I don't know. Do we? I don't have that information, but I could
magnitude?
Get it to you today, probably.
Just a magnitude?
Thank you.
Magnitude. Well, I will say that last year we had about 600, how many positions? I'll give you a magnitude.
Please.
Last year I had about 600 positions in our capital program, so we've ramped up to another 400. So I do know that 600 are filled. I do know that.
I guess it's maybe a kind of a silly question, but if could we not achieve the same thing by filling the positions that, and I know you're doing a heavy amount of recruitment right now too, so I'm not trying to wave a magic wand, but could you achieve the same thing by just filling the positions we have, or are they different kinds of positions?
They're different kinds of positions, yeah. And
this item goes strictly to the procurement IG piece.
These positions are specifically to procurement
and
IT.
Others.
So what happens is, and we always get caught up, especially in municipalities, or I know we don't look like a government, we don't act like one, but we are to some extent, right? So. everyone always struggles with positions and descriptions. So if you do what you suggest, then you take a position that's vacant, that's an IT position, and you'd have to now revamp the whole job description to fit to a program manager who is doing a capital position. And it's really not a very good personnel practice to do that. So you've
got to. Well, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just asking if that's what we're doing.
That's.
Are they different position descriptions? And that was the answer to that.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Barnes and then Mr. Costa.
Thank you. As the new kid here, I'm trying to figure out the process. Like all my colleagues, I've been on a lot of boards and commissions, and I've never been asked to vote on adding 30 positions before. These are decisions that the CEO and his team make. I don't know, and I don't know how any member of the board could know whether we need 22 more people or 33 more people. That's your job. Is there some strange requirement here at Metro that the board votes on how many staff you hire?
Yes.
This is bizarre.
Yes, that is bizarre. And so if I could be so candid. And it has been board practice in prior boards to approve headcount within the budget. And it does constrain us to some extent. And it contributes to a lot of the delays that we have in the bureaucratic process. So.
I've never seen anything like it, and maybe at another time, at the appropriate time, we could take a look at that because it's not the way to run a railroad.
Welcome again, Mr. Barnes. Mr. Acosta. Yeah,
just to follow up on that comment, which I agree to. I think it may be helpful to understand the overall staffing plan for the expanded capital program. And actually look at, you know, how many other, because I assume that these are two parts of the agency that are seeking additional staff. But there are other portions of the agency that you're going to be coming back to us for similar requests. And we've seen some already over the last couple of months. So I don't necessarily know if we could adopt a top number where, you know, not to exceed a certain, I don't know if we could do that. But it would be helpful to all of us to kind of understand, as we're seeing these things, how... what we're adopting, why we're reviewing this, and kind of what the needs are, so we just have a better sense of the needs of the staff needs of the agency over the next couple of years. I think this is important, and obviously I'm supportive of this, but I think there are a lot of questions here regarding kind of like, where are we going to see more? How many more of these things are we going to see over the next couple of months with respect to the capital plan?
Well, maybe we can put that in the conversation whether the board really wants to look at this all the time. Yeah. But we have, as part of ramping up for the capital program, we have put together a resource plan. We're not totally there, but we certainly can present 90% of it or something like that at this point if you'd like.
A comment, not micromanaging, I hope. The board just approved a $3 million project for asset management to do a better job not only of programming our capital going forward against depreciation and useful life, but to also assess the actual performance of assets that the authority has purchased that we have failed a lot at assessing things like escalator purchases, bus purchases, and even rail car purchases about their specific performance after purchase. I hope that the capacity is being built in the procurement process to assess actual performance, not just speeding up the process, but to make the process smarter as well. And the question is the integration of asset management into procurement. I know it's not part of what you're envisioning here. This is about volume. I hope that there is a component of this that deals with being smarter in the procurement process.
There is a component of this, and throughout the board orientation, we have told some of the new board members and the existing ones about the efforts on procurement streamlining with respect to master contracts, strategic sourcing, efforts on that nature that actually assist the assets actually that need to be in place, ready when you need them. And that effort is being very successful. We're measuring that effort. On another note, we are engaging with procurement and the asset management operations folks with regard to that process. Inventory planning has been a very weak area here at Metro, and we've recognized that and have put in place a lot of things to get it up to where it needs to be, so that you can be more forward-looking on your assets versus later. So we can bring back, and we have brought that progress to the general manager. Actually, he has meetings on it twice a month, sometimes weekly, and sometimes they're not good meetings, but anytime they're not good meetings, it means you're being stressed to make more progress on it. And so I think there has been a lot of progress on that front.
Just to add to that, it's one thing to buy commodities. So part of what we're looking for here is people who are in the contract area who are experienced in doing major project capital acquisitions. So it's a little different talent.
Out to contract or to move for the options, and what are our benefits that we are looking at, why we're choosing this option?
That is correct. Good morning. As you know, the end game of the presentation this morning was to recommend the exercise of the option, but I will walk back and give some background on how we came to that recommendation. One of the major drivers in making the decision about when to put the contract back out is the procurement cycle, and also the fact that communicating with the community about changes that might be made to the program is part of the lessons that we learned in the previous procurement, which was done in 2005. We also examined in making this decision the value of the current contract that we have, and as you'll see in the materials, this option is the final option on what adds up to an 8-year agreement. If we exercise the option, it locks in the pricing that was established at that time. It has been found to be competitive. And also, within the confines of the existing agreement, there is opportunity for us to continue to tweak the way that the service is delivered and scheduled to produce even further savings. And then as a backdrop behind all of this discussion is the fact that our demand management activities have been very successful over the last 2 years. The eligibility process that we use to determine who should be using the paratransit service or not has been substantially augmented. And what you now see is that many more of those little dots that you saw in that previous presentation of people circulating through the rail stations are people with disabilities who are finding that Metro's accessible bus and rail services are more convenient and allow for more independent travel. As a result of that, the previous growth rate of paratransit, which had been as high as 22% from 1 year to the next, as recently as FY09, is now down to only 3% this year, as opposed to the previous year. And our current 5-year projection on the demand for Metro access is that in the next several years, the demand is actually going to go down for the first time in the history of the program. This has allowed us to return $4 million from our previous request for FY12. And with all of those things taken into consideration, this presentation includes a timeline for the procurement, which we are estimating at between 18 and 24 months. This includes the vetting with the community, with various stakeholders for the funding aspect. Our Accessibility Advisory Committee has also reviewed this matter and recommended that part of that vetting should also include the release of an RFI request for information so that prospective bidders could give us some insights on what they think would be helpful in terms of the way the contract is structured, the pricing schedules, and the way that the service is deployed. There may be many options that bidders could look at, like bidding on, you know, pieces of the work, and are dealing with more than one entity as opposed to the current scenario, which is one prime with a set of subcontractors. Another component of that timeline is that we also want to allow ample startup time. For once the contract has been awarded, it takes time, obviously, for the successful bidder or bidders to acquire equipment, personnel, and most importantly, communicate with the community about what they can expect once the service transition starts. So this timeline on the screen gives a sense that the option period begins on July 1st. Staff was not intending to wait until July 1st to get busy. We are already working internally on cost estimates for potential future business models. We also have that vetting process underway, and also with the support of the Accessibility Advisory Committee, which, by the way, was recently visited by our CFO. They also have taken a greater interest in helping us to really look at how we can deliver the service in a more cost-effective way in the next iteration of the contract.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that presentation. Any additional questions?
In looking at the timeline, I appreciate the time that you've built in for public and stakeholder meetings, and I know that you have worked with the Access for All Committee of the Transportation Planning Board. When I was chair of that committee, we did work together, and you were I very much appreciate the kind things you said about the help that they gave you. And I'm assuming that Access for All Committee is going to be one of the stakeholders that you will continue to work with, because I think they have some additional input they'd like to provide too.
Yes, ma'am, in a couple of different ways. I mean, certainly directly with us, with that committee, but also as a result of the recent board action to have the advisory committee reporting to the board, the TPB Access for All Committee will now have two seats on our advisory committee, so they're going to be involved in two different ways. But the work that they did the last time in providing an independent review on the service has become really a template for us in a lot of ways for the service quality and the resources that are devoted to the project to meet performance standards.
Yes, Mr. McKay.
Yes. If you're a user of Metro Access, what things in the process that you go through will likely improve under this contract? In other words, it's not just who's driving you, but customer service, as you mentioned, dispatch center. Are all of these things up in the air under this contract option, or is it really just the vendor who is driving you somewhere?
Not at all. I think other business models will be entertained, and there are a number of reasons to do that. I mean, it's a broad region. A lot of our Metro Access customers travel quite a long ways across the region, and there are different ways to handle that. I mean, it could be handled in segments. The service could be regionalized or decentralized. There are a lot of different ways to deliver the service, and we really want to explore all of those things. And that's one of the reasons why we've incorporated so much vetting time in here, because given the fact that these are long contracts, we want to really get it right, and we want to get the very best information we can, lessons learned, best practices before we proceed.
One follow-up question. I think we're all aware of some of the unfortunate situations over the years with some drivers that are not working for Metro. They're working for a vendor. What are we doing in this process to try to deal, I guess, more proactively with that situation? Is there a screening process, requirements for drivers? Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on that, because I know it is a concern out there.
Absolutely. Well, one thing, we weren't waiting until this process to do that. That's already been done both by Metro and by our contractor. At one of the previous board meetings, we talked about the fact that MV had hired the former chief counsel from FTA, Pat Riley, to do an inquiry into some of the incidents that had occurred where there was driver misconduct, and he has presented a preliminary report to us with recommendations, and it covers everything from the standards of hiring, to who does those checks, and more elaborate review of the training process as well. So those things are underway presently, and that will be completed even before we get to this vetting. But we're going to open ourselves again in that vetting process to any further input that anyone else may have.
Mr. Downey, I'm sorry, Ms. Hines.
I agree that this is the length of time it will take to do a good job, and definitely we should set forth to do a good job, but it only will be as good as the front end in thinking about it. I think the outreach to stakeholders is very important, but I would also point to point four, board approval to initiate solicitation. I think that has to be a very robust process. Identify what the objectives are we have with respect to the service, quality, security, cost, various business models, and give us an opportunity to think about the options before we go forward, because we'll get what we ask for. We'll get the best we can get that we ask for, but we'll only get what we ask for.
Ms. Hines.
Mr. Kent, we actually have two different things going on here. One is we're looking forward and thinking about that process to get to the new one, but we still have this period when MV is going to be our contractor. You've been able to reduce our costs some. This extension of the exercise of the option, you're saying you hope to be able to reduce our costs again, so that would be below the 111 million. That's the outer bound on this contract option.
Yes.
My concern is, as you continue to work with the contractor, are there things here where our riders, our Metro Access users, are going to be surprised, where it hits their pocketbook in a different way, or changes how they feel about the service we provide in this interim period, and how do those things get vetted so that we don't have people calling us at home complaining?
Yes, that's certainly a valid point. In all of the discussions that I have had with our general manager, that has been a major consideration. We've already implemented the fare increase. And that process was one in which we considered the customer impact. That's one reason why there was the grandfathering provision to allow those who were traveling out of corridor to continue to do that. No further revenue-based changes would be anticipated, and certainly they'd have to come here if that were going to be part of the equation. But this has more to do with really just efficiency improvements, and we're able to accomplish those things just by changes in our management approach.
So no service type changes either. I mean, those are the two things where we would tend to hear it.
The only service related change that we had put out for conceptual consideration was the notion that we would look for opportunities to feed paratransit customers into the fixed route system, as opposed to taking a nonstop trip on paratransit. But we would not mandate that. That's certainly, if it was a mandated program, then that would be something we would again have to return to the board for. But there are many customers who really want to do that. As we talk with them more, they say, if you could just get me to that stop or that rail station, I'm happy to take Metro Bus or Metro Rail the rest of the way. So we're going to increase that dialogue with customers to offer that opportunity.
Okay, but not a requirement.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Yule.
Yeah, I just want to thank staff for their excellent work in this area. Certainly my almost 11 years on the board, and from day one, I've always had concerns and problems about Metro Access and the management of it and the operation of it and the abuse of it and the like. But to hear the good news about the percentage decreases in terms of participants and so forth and the budgetary savings that we're beginning to realize, I think is a move in the right direction. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Do we have a motion on the floor?
Comment. I just wanted to I'm not sure where we're going with Mr. Downey's suggestion. I very much appreciate all the work that has been done on Metro Access, but I think his suggestion that there ought to be a general board discussion early in this contract process of the board's goals and what we're trying to accomplish in this new contract, I think would be very useful. And I'm not sure where that suggestion is going.
Mr. Downey's suggestion goes to the work that I think the staff and the board must do before we go out for that contract. And I guess this goes to the point I think Mr. Downey and I asked at the last March meeting, that why not at the time were we not going out? And the point being that we wanted to have as much discussion in preparation for going out and soliciting a contract. We talked about specifically our customers from the accessibility community, but it's largely what are the goals in paratransit that we want, and how are we going to satisfy them, and what the contract is going to be able to bring to us.
So there will be scheduled a further board discussion looking at those issues.
That's the
early in the process.
Yes. That's the intent of that task four, which is that we wanted to come back with some conceptual pieces for the board to review before we went too much further down the road.
There are, as I read the timeline, about 6 or 7 months, and I would hope to have at least a couple of interim discussions before we're presented it. We want to move it quickly so the rest of the process can happen. Could I just ask a question about the next slide on contract period performance objectives?
Next slide, please.
My reading of this says these are things you believe you can get within the existing contract period, even if we exercise the option now. Good faith efforts with the current vendor to provide these kinds of things will be beneficial to us without being harmful to them.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Ms. Hine moved. Mr. McKay second. Discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much, and thank you for the work. I think it is I hope our customers can look forward to their engagement in this. The next item is the approval to rescind two reimbursable projects, and these are two projects that were intended to be implemented, received FTA funding, were unable to meet their match, were unable to negotiate congressionally how to use those funds, so we are meeting the FTA requirement to.
Great. I'm going to have Matt Brown just take you through the context of this discussion, and Jack is here to discuss the details.
Sure, and just real quickly, we're seeking board approval to deobligate funds related to two bus projects, both funded with earmarked federal dollars for buses that ultimately weren't purchased. Efforts were made with the Virginia Congressional Delegation to repurpose the funds. Unfortunately, those efforts were not successful. In the case of the first, the Fair Lakes bus purchase, Fair Lakes is a private entity. They sought to own and operate the buses. That's something that's not allowed by FTA rules, and so the project was not executed. There were no match funds received by Metro. In the second case, with the Falls Church bus purchase, it was intended to operate a shuttle during construction of the West Falls Church station garages. The buses weren't procured in the time frame required, and Metro provided existing buses, and so these weren't needed. In this case, there was a match of $182,000 that was provided by DRPT. The proposal here is to return the match funds to DRPT. So the recommendation is, again, to rescind the two reimbursable projects, to deobligate the FTA funds, and then to return the match to DRPT.
So moved.
Question. Were these earmarks that WMATA sought or earmarks that others sought that we inherited?
I don't know if you may know the answer to that question. My grants person. Sheila, would you know the answer to that question? If they were inherited earmarks that we actually inherited or from others, or if they were earmarks that Metro sought specifically.
I didn't find a record of who had initiated the earmark request with Congress.
Okay, so. Thank you, Brian.
They were inherited by WMATA.
Okay, thank you.
Sought by others and inherited by
Mr. Reckler.
Yes, I think that Jack Reek was just a general manager for BUS. I think in cooperation with both entities, I think it was inherited, but it was certainly we were well-intended intentions to operate both of those services.
Chair. You mentioned on the Fair Lakes bus purchase that attempts were made to repurpose. Can you describe those? What did we attempt to do? What did we try to use the funding for with our, I guess, I don't know if it would have approved, needed congressional approval or not, but you used the term, we tried to repurpose the money for other things. Can you explain that?
I'm sorry. There was a request that was written by former general manager John Cato to Mr. Moran in the House of Representatives, and I'm looking for the exact language regarding repurposing of the funds, just indicating that we couldn't use them.
This was in 2009, so there was attempts that were made.
So we haven't,
a few years ago.
There haven't been any other attempts made recently.
Not that I'm aware of now.
I mean, the only question I have is a lot's changed since 2009. And, you know, and frankly, a lot's getting ready to change at the end of this year with the federal government and the BRAC moves and other things and the need for shuttle services and transportation services and transit and other challenges that we face in the county. And I, you know, I'm comfortable doing this, but I do raise the issue that, you know, before we give up on funding, the repurposing part is important, and if we don't think there's a way to repurpose it in 2011, if there's a legal reason we can't, that's one thing, but if there's a lack of projects or lack of need, that's a totally different thing.
The request was to repurpose them for WMATA bus and bus facilities. But it's certainly something we can follow up on just to make sure that there's a final.
I'm okay voting to support this, but I would just say before we actually completely do this, let's make darn certain that there's not some other, let's make contact again since it's been since 2009 with the folks involved and make sure that there's not a way to repurpose it in 2011 before we walk away from
it. And we will do that. I will say that there have been efforts. I think the effort that the general manager made at the time made that effort, but staff has made that effort,
clarity.
You know, and from the grants office to the FTA, right, and I have made that effort, but it's a very specific purpose, and they have been unable to, we have been unable to find a window of opportunity to use those funds for something else. We can certainly explore that again, but and Brian Glenn is shaking his head no, but sitting over there.
FDA had given WMATA specific direction that we were going to unilaterally close out and take back the money as of the end of April, and they are following through. The staff is following through on that notice to WMATA. So there is no opportunity.
These funds will be obligated by FDA
to maintain.
And this
should have
come to
us earlier.
That.
The scope that they under the ability to change.
Yes.
The agency has had 4 or 5 years to get these funds reprogrammed. They have been unsuccessful in doing so through several general managers and through several offices. Have been unsuccessful in doing so. And therefore, at the last quarterly meeting that we held in January, we notified the agency that we were going to close out these grants by the end of the
Mr. Downey.
Yeah, it's my recollection that repurposing actually requires an act of Congress. Yeah. This having been put in the statute as an earmark, it has to go back, and even Congress is not willing to do that. And I would say take a look as well at the continuing resolution that passed the other night, or is passing now. It's on the floor now. They're axing all old earmarks. They're going away.
Madam Chair, thanks. I'm still learning here. This is the kind of item I would expect to see as a board member just for our information that this is happening.
Yeah.
Not that
Absolutely.
It would be something we'd be voting on because, as I understand what's there's been presented to us, is there's nothing here really for us to vote on. so just I would hope in the future that these kinds of items we would just maybe get a memo saying this is what's happened.
I just comment on that. We have changed the board policy to do that. We actually improved on it last year,
and I'm all with you, but we'll have to change board policy in order to do that.
Thank you very much. All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
And opposed? Thank you very much. The last item is the reprogramming of capital budget funds.
And I'll have Matt go through this.
Let me give a background.
At the risk of saying that this should fall under the board policy, we will go through this one again. This is a reprogramming.
Thank you. This is a request to move funds. As you know, we're in an expenditure-based budget. These kinds of items will come periodically before the board under our current reprogramming policy that, by the way, sunsets in October, so that's an opportunity to revisit the reprogramming policy that we're currently working under. The current request is to fund work at parking garage. Parking garage is at the Largo station, and to install station operator consoles or socks and automatic fare collection equipment. The projects, so those are the two projects that we propose to fund. The funds that are available are from CIP 038, the bus garage capacity enhancement project, and $500,000 from the debit credit processing requirements. Those funds are not required in the fiscal year for either of those projects. In the first case, the storage facility can be built at a cost less than lower than originally projected. And then with the debit credit processing requirements, anticipated work that would need to be done in order to bring us into compliance with the payment card industry is not required after an audit that was completed this year. So that's why the funds are available. This is the work that will be done at the Largo garages. It's to repair damage that resulted during snowstorms. You can see here the pictures of the work that needs to be done, and it's anticipated that the $1 million that we're requesting can be spent before the end of the fiscal year.
Yes, remind us when this station was completed. How long ago?
I believe it was six years ago.
Okay. Yeah.
And have we had similar experiences at our garages throughout the system?
No, I'll have Lou
Viner. I think, I'm not exactly sure, but I
hit
think.
Hit your button, please.
Hi, I'm Lou Viner. I'm the acting director for IR for Infrastructure Renewal Program. I'm not exactly sure of the date when the garage was opened. I am going to guess around 2006. And we have not seen exactly this type of damage at all of our other garages, although we have had an incident down in Virginia at one of our older garages where there was also damage that occurred as a result of the snow being piled up on the upper deck of the garage. And we had to go in and take repairs to some of the T-beams that were in that garage. We actually went in and replaced two of the T-beam spans.
Okay. I'm in the construction business myself, but this shouldn't be occurring so early. And I would beg that we review our design principles and so forth, because this, unless this was just faulty construction on the part of the general contractor, we should not be engaged in this exercise this early in the game.
I agree. We do not feel as though it was faulty construction, although we haven't ruled that out. We are reviewing the design and the situation that led to the repairs.
Okay.
Just may I ask a clarification? You said construction, and what about maintenance?
It could be maintenance, although in this particular case, there may be some maintenance issues. We're going to have to take a look at the entire situation and then make an assessment.
As I understand it, this goes back to the huge snowstorm and the way,
yes.
The way the plowing was done and the way the snow was loaded.
Correct.
In the garage. So you have to look at whether he overstressed it.
Yeah, Mayor, you'll hit it right on the head. This shouldn't have happened this soon. Certainly, I would agree with the design review you're going through. I would look at the design. Certainly, the chair has mentioned maintenance. And looking at the garages around our system, we over-design them. I mean, they're like mausoleums, for God's sake. So how this had happened, I don't know. Certainly, a snow load would be a uniform load, not a point load. So I'm a little concerned about that.
It's plowed.
Is it? Okay, so they were storing it that way? But it concerns me, and we should definitely look at the design, not just the construction of it.
But we should also look at what our practice is with respect to snow removal or snow storage.
Right.
Might I differentiate with, may I differentiate, when you said Virginia Garage, were you saying a Metro Garage or another Virginia Garage?
A Metro Garage.
Okay, all right, that's all I want to take up, sure. Okay, any other, yeah. Well, we've had a different one, but it was not a different reason, so that's why I wanted to make sure that we were talking consistently about Metro design and this failure versus one that was not. Okay. Any other questions regarding the item? The reprogramming is the request before us.
The second of the three items proposed for the reprogramming are the station operators consoles. These are being replaced throughout the system. Many are at the end of their useful lives. The SOX provide station managers with information about patrons' fare cards. If they have trouble, they can go to the fare to the kiosk, and the station manager uses the SOX to help the customers. Again, replacements needed because units are at the end of the useful life. This will allow us to begin this project this year. We will replace between 55 and 60 of the devices. The remaining will be replaced in the next fiscal year, in fiscal year 12. And finally, again, this is work that we are advancing related to the NextVerse system. $800,000 is needed mainly for force account or in-house labor associated with upgrades to the NextVerse system. This includes many of the things that you've noticed and that have been appearing in our stations, the dome target enclosures, which in many cases are improving the customer experience as they pass through the fare gates. That requires force account labor, especially contractor escorts. So that's what this request is for. Together, they make up $2 million. So that's the projects that have available funds, reprogramming to the projects in need of the dollars, and that's the board request.
Is there a motion for approval? Made by Ms. Hines, a second? Second? Second by Mr. Giancola. Are there further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. It's the end of our action items. We have two. Administrative items, ridership and revenue on our assessment of fare changes, and the second is, of course, our monthly financial report that is at the end of our calendar always.
Great. Let's keep so this is an information item that I think will prove interesting. This has been requested for quite some time from the board as a whole to try to determine where are we with our revenues in terms of the implementation of some of the guidelines of fare policy pricing. What's happened this year? Has it been effective? Have we been aligned with our policy? What are the results? And we've done a bit of analysis that Michael Eichler is going to take you through. He's a very good analyst in our planning department, has worked with a team of people to look at this. Let me frame this up, thank you, for him, but by saying that this, because it got a little bit of a confusion, I think, with the press specifically, but this is a snapshot of 5 months of revenue, and we started in September, September to January. We looked at this September to January and compared it to last September and January. And the reason why we did September to January is because, if you recall, we were in the middle of doing a major conversion of our fare collection system in July. We did a big cutover. Upgraded our fare collection system in the middle of a fare increase, one of the biggest that we've had in recent times. And we had a lot of bumps along the road. So I did not want to taint the data by looking at the first quarter, because I was very concerned that that data would actually kind of skew the results. So we got a lot of that behind us, and then we looked at, that's why we chose that period of September to January. So with that said, I'll have Michael take you through that comparison analysis to prove out some of the theories that we've had.
Good afternoon, members of the board. Again, my name is Michael Eichler. I'm a senior planner in the Office of Long-Range Planning. If you want to flip to the purpose slide, basically we had four goals for this analysis. The first is we wanted to see how well a recently adopted fair policy lined up with our current fare structure. Secondly, we wanted to see how sensitive our riders are to the fare increase. It was, you know, the biggest fare increase that Metro has had. We wanted to see how well our riders reacted to that. We also wanted to check in with the ridership and revenue actuals and see how well they compare with our projections. And then we also wanted to just review briefly our customers' perspectives on the current fare structure. So the fare policy versus the fare structure, I would say that we are doing a pretty good job of meeting a lot of the fare policy principles. The Smart Trip card does a good job of getting people into the system quickly and easily. And our ridership is really strong still on some of our more specialized routes, or you know, after midnight service, express and airport services. And our increases in pass use and seniors and disabled trips helps us see that we are accommodating our special needs passengers well. However, there is also noted some room for improvement within our current fare structure. Our passengers are deeming that our fare structure is a little complicated and they'd like it to be more simple, easier to understand, easier to communicate to other people. One of our fare policy principles was to try to optimize the use of underused capacity on the system, and we thought that this pop surcharge could help maybe move a few people into, you know, out of the most congested times, and we haven't really seen a very large shift due to this fare increase. So if you want to look specifically at how Metro Rail is doing.
And can I just stop for a moment? Because just for new members, the POP is the peak of the peak, and it was in place in the morning during rush hour, 7:30 to 9, and then in the evening during that rush hour period as well. And
4:30 to 6.
Thank you. And so what we were expecting at the peak of the peak, you're paying more at that demand period. We really didn't see, as Michael indicated, people moving outside of that window. People have to commute. I guess, you know, the principle didn't really result in any different patterns from a behavior aspect. So really all it achieved was that people are just paying more for that period during the demand rush hour. So
moving directly to Metro Rail, we did see in this five-month period a small decrease in ridership over the same period of the previous year. However, we did not see that the ridership was as responsive as maybe we had thought. We use certain values called elasticities when evaluating how ridership will respond to fare changes, and the fare changes, the reaction that we saw was generally less than what the elasticity would have stated. We are seeing a pretty significant shift from fare cards to Smart Trip. We had a pretty decent Smart Trip use rate previously, and we now also have a surcharge for paper fare cards, and that got us 3% more within this five-month period towards Smart Trip usage. We did see some small shifts within the peak of the peak period, about 3% for both AM and PM. And also, we didn't really see any decrease. We actually saw an increase in trips of people receiving the full benefit, the full federal benefit on their smart benefits. Those trips are actually up by 2.5%, whereas the in general ridership was slightly down. So that indicates that obviously our federal employees who are receiving full benefits are insensitive to the fare increase. And if you want to just look at the chart briefly, one thing that's notable is that despite the fare increase, we're actually seeing a relatively large increase in ridership during the weekend days and the after midnight peak. Especially considering that there's a 51% increase in the after midnight rail fare that was part of the fare increase. So people, they still want to use those late night services. If we flip over to bus, we broke this.
Question on the rail slide. We're stating that a 3% shift in Smart Trip is significant, but saying a 3% shift in peak of the peak is not. So what I'd like to see, not today, but if you could provide for us, on the peak of the peak, what are the absolute numbers of riders who were moved? And then what impact did that have on loadings? And my guess is it's going to turn out to be less than one person per car, but I'd like to know that.
Madam Chair, could I ask one other question on this, too? I am aware that the federal subsidy got carried forward into this fiscal year. And I'm assuming that we tied Peak of the Peak in some way. We had some sense that the benefits from the feds would kind of be in that mix. So my question is, really, what would happen if the SMART benefit or the SMART benefits went back to the previous level? Because we don't know, I don't know if we know if the feds are continuing that forward or not. But I just wonder what are, you know, how, what percent of those Peak of the Peak riders are actually using SMART benefit, and if it goes away or becomes less, will we see some other result?
Yeah, I think the general idea that we are understanding right now is that the maximum fare for the Metro Rail system is $5.20 if you're using a Smart Trip card, and you need Smart Trip card to do Smart benefits. And a full month's worth of fares at $5.20 doesn't go beyond the actual total previous amount of Smart benefits. So the up and above won't really affect people who are only commuting on Metro Rail or and I believe even Metro Bus to Metro Rail connections. I think that additional dollar amount for the SMART benefits is above and beyond, and most likely applies to people who are purchasing combination passes of commuter rail and Metro Rail or other sorts of services.
And Michael is right. We do have a small amount of people who don't get the full benefit on federal benefits. And I think we have done some analysis on what would impact those. It's a smaller subset of that. And it's anywhere from $5 or $10 million, but it's certainly a guess. We actually look at the portion of people who have that. But he's actually right.
Thank you for your analysis. It's interesting. I was not here when, in terms of what was initially done, but my understanding is, and it kind of gets at what Ms. Hines was talking about, is that the goal was to maximize revenue, was to increase revenue for Metro. And, you know, and utilize and leverage certainly any area to be able to do that. But you brought the issue up. The goal is not necessarily to shift ridership, but apparently you looked at that in terms of shifting to manage capacity. Is there anything, any thoughts about that in terms of what you learned in terms of if we were going to do performance pricing to maximize ridership? Did we learn anything from that rather than did we scare riders off with higher fare?
That's a really good question. I was actually a member of the team who did the assessment for the Peak of the Peak fare when it was being evaluated for inclusion in the docket in the first place. So I have an experience of how that analysis was done, what sort of things we were expecting. And basically, we expected some riders to stick it out. We expected some to shift to other times of the day. We expected some to leave the Metro Rail system in general. We have done this analysis and just to see how our previous analysis had worked out and decided that turns out that most people are willing to pay an extra 20 cents. They're not going to want to change the time of day. They don't have a lot of freedom. And it's still a cheaper alternative for them than driving or taking another mode.
But a different approach would have been, if we were looking at performance pricing, to actually use dropping fare during the low demand times and a commensurate increase during high demand times. So since we were looking to raise revenue, that we use this approach. But if it were performance pricing, we would actually look at a way to try to shift our ridership in a way to maximize the capacity of Metro. Is that correct?
I believe that is correct. I would say that the general thought was if there are any discretionary trips during the peak period and that we would like to gently ask them with a 20-cent surcharge to make that trip at another time. I think what we've learned is that there aren't that many discretionary trips happening during the peak period, primarily because the system is so congested and there are so many riders that it's just inconvenient to take the trip during the peak of the peak unless you really need to.
The point I want to make is that it doesn't seem like this was a fair test to try to maximize capacity on Metro through performance pricing as much as this was a way to raise revenue, and we'll see what happens to the ridership.
I think I would agree with you on that. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Comment on that.
think it was sold to us as a means of dealing with congestion. It was not a revenue measure. We talked about revenue, and then we talked about this might be one way to do it. Maybe we've proven it didn't work.
Well, then we would have
I'm not sure that lowering the off-peak would have any more effect than raising the peak, but we don't know. But it was intentionally presented as a staff proposal to deal with peak congestion, not part of a revenue package. Yeah.
Sure. So we can. Sure. So just quickly on the bus side, we are seeing a moderate decrease during this time period. And even though, you know, when we break down to the different bus submarkets, we're finding that the bus riders themselves are actually not as responsive to the fare increase as our normal planning statistics would result. I think the most notable is that we have a 91% increase on our airport buses, but only a 15% decrease on the ridership of those buses. So obviously those have a very high demand, and that they were underpriced before, and now maybe we're getting closer to the appropriate price for them. We are also seeing a very large shift to Smart Trip. There was a 20-cent cash surcharge now on Metrobus from $1.50 with Smart Trip to $1.70 without, and we saw nearly a 10% increase. And actually, if you look at the numbers today, it's actually almost up to 85%. So, again, the analysis period only was until January, but we got 76% then. If you look at today's number, it's even higher, which is great. One thing to note is that there is an issue of passengers loading their Smart Trip cards on the bus, and that our load value is actually relatively low, and that can sometimes impact the performance of the bus, as many passengers are waiting behind someone who's trying to load a small dollar amount onto a Smart Trip card. So we may want to consider ways to encourage people to load larger dollar values, therefore loading less frequently. And that would be something to look at. Pardon me?
Or greater options for loading places.
Right, or greater options for loading, such
as... Some of the things, we're looking at some of the areas where the queue happens more frequently and trying to determine how to either put a kiosk where they can actually load that's nearby, rather than loading on the bus. So we're evaluating that now.
So if you want to flip to the next slide, where this is where we're comparing the actuals for the five-month period versus the projections for the five-month period. We can see that each of these charts for ridership, revenue, and average fare list last year is the first data point, the budgeted number, and then the current value for this year, we're referring to it. And that we did a pretty good job. We're within 6% of all of the budgeted numbers. And we can see that our average fare has increased and on bus and rail. Our revenue has increased, and our ridership is only slightly down versus the projections, as well as for last year's numbers. And then finally, we did work with some focus groups in October to assess their reaction to our current fare structure. They had some really good feedback for us. One of the comments was that, Smart Trip is the way to go. They really like the Smart Trip card. They also appreciate passes. As we're working currently to load passes onto Smart Trip, that's obviously a double bonus for them. There are some areas for improvement, as we noted before, in the fare policy principles. Our customers do not like how complicated the fare structure is. And they also feel like we're not doing the best job of communicating that complicated fare structure to the passengers. So it's kind of a double whammy. It's complicated to understand, and also we could do better at communicating it. And they're also asking and clamoring for more options, for more ways to purchase Smart Trip cards, to have more options available. They're also looking to open payment systems, such as being able to pay with an RFID credit card or with a cell phone. But again, they still want those features in addition to Smart Trip, not as a replacement for Smart Trip. I think that there's, in general, a general consensus that we are doing a pretty good job and that there's some opportunities for improvement.
I realize that this is cutting it more finely, but there are differences on demographics. It'd be interesting to know if you're able to move into that at all, because on the one hand, in D.C., we have a very high proportion of folks that are what we call unbanked, and that they don't use banks. And the degree to which, if we were able to sell Smart Trip cards at essentially, you know, check cashing money order places would be an interesting option to see if that increased the sale of the Smart Trip cards. But the other thing is that we see increased ridership on weekends and at night, and I'm wondering if there's if that's a different demographic, and also what if there's any way to test the value of increasing IT enhanced communication for those that were looking to see what the fare would be, let's say on their smartphone or something like that. I realize that's a complex question.
Was it really a question, or was it more of a?
I'm wondering. Well, I'm curious to see if you were able to disaggregate by demographics in terms of the impact of these things.
Let me try.
Yes.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, we do. It's a great point. We, as you know, or maybe you do not, but we do surveys. But we don't do them as regularly. I think the last one we did was probably in 2007. And typically we do surveys to tell us a bunch of things. One of them is the demographics of our riders. It helps us determine subsidy more than anything. And that's kind of the basis of the survey, as well as it gives us some customer input on how to move forward. To your point specifically, we have engaged an entity to help us building a model, a revenue model, if you will, to address not just to address market segments, demographics. They'll have to do a survey, and we're talking about that now, to try to understand the behavior more of our customers, their price points, how they would like to look at information, whether it's on an app or if it's, you know, some other vehicle. And that is actually being kicked off between Matt, myself, and we're looking to do that survey sometime in the summer, working with Barbara Richardson on communications. So we're getting there, but the data that we have now is relatively old, 2007, and although we do surveys every once in a while, it's not as comprehensive as the one that you're suggesting.
I appreciate that because, you know, clearly just in your graphics here of the fare structure is complicated, and you look at fare tables, and, you know, that's certainly the lowest level of technology. If that is one of the main sources for the fare tables, and we see how much our riders are moving to smart cards to get cash and change out of the transaction, which helps move people more quickly, but people have adapted to that, and the degree to which we can build on that, of course, is increases the experience, makes it easier. Thanks.
I just have a quick question. I know as part of the move to Smart Trip that the board authorized a certain number of cards to go out into our social service agencies to, in some ways, deal with this some of the issues that Tommy was talking about. I don't know if staff has any sense of how many of those are still left to be distributed, what the social service agency's experience has been, but I would be really interested in learning more about how that's worked and whether we need to make adjustments.
We can come back with you for that. I will tell you the there are balances left of the smart cards at social service agencies throughout the jurisdictions. One of the primary reasons is because it's difficult to use. What we've heard from some of the customers who participate in agencies like that with social services, they actually prefer tokens because they get a token and they get it at that entity, at that agency, they then use it, and then they go back and they get another one. With a Smart Trip card, then they have to figure out how to add value to it. It just becomes more of a complicated transaction. We are aware of that, and we've worked with our social service agencies to help with that. But we can come back to the board with a broader recommendation on how to move forward to change that.
And I would just share that in my jurisdiction, I've asked our staff to see if we can't get a Smart Trip loader at our social service agency so that they could, when they come for their appointment, have the equivalent of that token given to them and put on their Smart Trip card. So we're working that through, but I think whatever we learn might be applicable in a broader way.
I think there's a larger piece to connect that, though. I think what Tommy is saying is that there has to be a very robust, high-tech way that we can update these. And the social service agencies need that because sometimes it's not a client that's ever going to come back or won't come back in the time of which they need a subsidy. So how do we address it? And that's why I think people are holding on to the one thing that they know. And if you think about what this data has told us about our customers and identify who our customers are and their needs, we really are not only talking to folks who are savvy and have a lot of options, we're talking to people who don't have options, and we still have not been able to reach them in a very efficient way. So I think hopefully that'll help us to do that. Yeah. Mr. Down.
With respect to the complexity of the system, is it your sense that it is a distance-based fare per se is complex, or is it the way we have to present it with multiple time periods and multiple columns on the chart? I mean, distance-based ought to be relatively well understood. It's been the basis for 35 years on the system.
I would personally say from some of the research that I've done that it is a combination, that a distance-based fare by its nature with 86 stations and three different time periods, of course, is going to be complicated, but that complication can be alleviated by better communication. And one of the things that's in the appendix is the listing of the individual fare policy principles that were adopted in November and how they compare with the fare structure and then how well we're doing. And number two is to establish a mechanism to allow customers to determine their fares easily. It doesn't say anything about the fares being easy to understand. It says that we should need a mechanism to communicate them. So, and in that respect, you know, I believe the board, when they made this policy, stated that they're okay with a complicated distance-based fare as long as we do a good job of communicating it. And I believe that's where we could do some better work. Perhaps we need a touch screen displays or maybe a map at every station that shows the fares actually on the map instead of in a table with, you know, different colors, color coding to correspond different times of day to different colored prices to give people an idea for, you know, oh, I'm going there, it says $2.75, that's my fare. So there are options.
I will say one thing, and as a result of the customer focus group, this came out clearly that many people who use Smart Trip Card, and it's in the 80% now, don't really have any idea of the value that they have on their card. They have a general knowledge. It's, you know, I have 20 or 50 bucks, I think. And then the other question that we've asked is, well, how much is your trip? And the answer is, you know, I think it's around 4 or 5 or 6. I mean, so the concept there is, I'm not really sure. And, of course, that changes by the demographic that you're speaking with. The customer focus group was a broad demographic. We had frequent riders, non-frequent riders, representatives from every demographic that we can have. But that was the general consensus. So it led us to believe that it's the ease of the system that they like. And that is why we are going towards the direction of trying to figure out alternate ways to pay, easy access to pay, what you have in your pocket, maybe your phone app or something like that. And we're bringing back the board to the board some of that analysis and the project that we have ongoing over the next few months. But that told us a lot about fares and how they're communicated.
Okay. If we have any other questions. I'm trying to move us quickly through this, and it is very good information for us, and I thank you, Mr. Eichler, in terms of the kind of data you've collected, because we do want to do the last item and get 5 minutes at least on where we are in the financials. Did I leave any information off of that you really want to go? Or
no, the last two slides were just summary information, but okay. There may be another question over here.
Do you have a question, Mr. Costa?
Just a suggestion. This is a very good presentation. It was very useful information. I think you'll probably learn more. I assume you're going to continue to collect information over the next few months. I think that we're not going to look at fares, obviously, in this budget cycle. I think it would be helpful for this board to have a discussion about fair policy again towards the end of this year before the general manager formulates his FY 2013 budget. I think there are issues about the effectiveness of the peak and whether we want to continue that because that would lead to more fair simplification, for instance. There have been a number of proposals out there to look at passes, but also we have to look at kind of whether our technology can catch up to that at this point. So there are a number of questions and issues that we should review before we get into the heat of whether we're going to use this as a way to raise more revenue so we can do this in the most efficient way possible, but also have a real discussion about, you know, what we're trying to deal with in terms of our customers and how we're going to make this a simpler system for them.
Yes, to add to that discussion, we should include the issue of indexing, which we did in fact incorporate a few budget cycles ago. Every 2 years, we're supposed to index our fare structure. So I'd want to have that as part of the discussion.
Thank you very much.
We'll now move to the financial report, and I'd ask that we highlight the 125 and probably skip to 128 quickly through those two. We hate to shortchange this. There's some information that's important to us that we want to focus. There's a lot of data included to background on highlighting.
Sure, and I'll highlight those pieces of information. And this is on page 125 of your booklets. As of February, we're on budget, as we have been for the last several months. The subsidy, or net budget, which is the difference between revenues and expenditures, is actually 3% or $11 million below budget. So we're in good shape year-to-date. Year-to-date expenditures you see there are $34.7 million below budget. The drivers are listed there, nearly $9 million in fringe benefits. That's roughly split between health and pension costs. Those costs have been less than anticipated in the budget. Services, about $9 million. Some of that is timing with IT purchases and some of our purchases in transportation infrastructure. There are some savings, though, year-to-date. In the CFO's office, smart trip expenditures are less than were projected in the budget. The big item that we talk about every month is propulsion and diesel. It's a combination of hedges and, in some cases, usage, where we've saved year-to-date nearly $18 million. And then the other piece of that falls in the next category, utilities, insurance, and other of 10.3. 8.7 of that amount is related to utilities. So, again, continuing the trend of the propulsion and diesel, our energy costs are down compared to the budget. We do have some unfavorable items. These, again, are those that we've talked about before. Salary, wages, and overtime together are $5.8 million over budget. This is due to bus and rail operator vacancies, as well as some unanticipated repairs to equipment that also affect the supply line, which is next, $5.6 million over budget. And the unanticipated repairs are listed there, mainly lighting and brake parts. So those are the unfavorable items that net out to the $34.7 million favorable on the expenditure side. Year-to-date revenues are down. We talked a lot about ridership, and so I won't go into a lot of details there, but year-to-date we're down $14.6 million in rail revenue and $4.9 on bus revenue. I will touch on the next couple pages just briefly. We've talked a lot about ridership, and again, this looks at the full fiscal year, where the previous presentation looked at a subset. Total ridership to date is up 1.6%. A lot of that has to do with February. As you can see, in February of last year, when we had the snowstorms, there was a big drop. So now, year to date, we're up total rail ridership 1.6%. Average weekday ridership, though, is still about 1% below last year. We've had it's up in Saturday, down on the Sunday periods, so it's mixed results. FY10. Year-to-date, we had about 137 million trips. Total for the current fiscal year, we're about 140. So we're holding our own on rail ridership. Bus is the next picture. And bus presents a glimmer of hope. If you see the purple box, it's not only above February, which we would expect because of the snowstorms, but charted against the green line, which is the budget, slightly over budget, about 2%. It's too early to call that a trend, but it's certainly a positive sign on bus ridership, something that we're going to continue to look at as we finalize the FY12 budget. And finally, with regard to capital expenditures, our expenditure rate is approximately the same as last year, but because of the increased program, we've actually spent year-to-date nearly $110 million more than we did last year. I mean, we've talked about some of our challenges that we're facing in spending our money, but we are making progress, and I think this is indicative of that.
So, Ms. Kissel, yes. Looking in your crystal ball, are we going to see a surplus at the end of the year? And would you lay out the options to the board about what would happen if we had a surplus?
Okay. So, I'm not going to answer that yet.
Smartly.
But I will say that it's hopeful that we'll come in at a very positive way, given some of the trends that were happening. We have, you know, a few months left to the end of the fiscal year. I will say that we'll be coming back to the board next month because we did get a reimbursement for snow last year on about $2 million? Just short of $2 million. And what I will recommend to the board is to apply that amount, because it's a very, it's coming from someplace else, to preventive maintenance levels that were put in the budget this year. And under board policy, if you recall, if there's a surplus funds at any given time, I would be bringing back that recommendation to pay back, if you will. Certainly, at the end of the month, I'd like to wait for the other end of the year to see if there's other surplus, but that would be my recommendation to pay back that to the preventative maintenance fund, which would give us more capital to do some other projects. So I think it's going to be positive in answer to your question.
Yeah, if there were such a surplus, in fact, that was what we enacted when the budget was put in place. First use would be,
right. That's right.
But in terms of the prospects of having that, we're well under budget at this point on diesel fuel, but there's 6 months to go, and I'm sure it's now running above budget.
There's 4 months to go.
Four months to go.
That's right. And it's and as you, when I have the benefit of seeing my weekly results as of now. I don't give them to you, not yet, because we haven't formalized them. But it does look positive. So it does look like we're going to come in at the end of the year with some type of a benefit or a surplus. I just don't know the amount. And as Mrs. Sorrells indicated, it is more a benefit because of the energy costs that we have seen in the program. We've benefited from that greatly on the propulsion usage, as well as, you know, the hedge contracts that we put in place are both actually helping that effort. So.
And conclude.
I'll just continue that the. We're up about $110 million as compared with last year. The next page gives some highlights of what we've spent the money on this year. As you know, we've made the initial payment on the 7,000 series rail cars. Our bus procurements are along the way. We're procuring Metro Access vehicles, advancing the rehab of the line contract, specifically the red line contract, which is listed here. So work is underway on the capital program and just looking to increase the speed of that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we have lots of data behind that, the presentation. So I appreciate the information we have there. But it does give us a glimmer that, one, the capital is where we want it to be and continuing in progress there. And I guess we will wait to see on the other. Are there any questions, Mr. Nichols?
It's just an information question for a bus. Once we place an order, how long does it take to get a production? What is it? What's the lead time on buses? Yes.
Jack?
Jack, for bus. I'm trying to remember when we placed the order. First of all, the arrival of the new buses will start later this month and go through the end of December. We'll have 152 new buses. I think it was about 6 months from the start. It kind of depends on what they have open on the line. The bus that we're buying was very similar to the last bus that we're buying. Once we agree on an award, a contract, it kind of depends on what the openings in their production line. So we try to encourage it. We're able to save some money by moving some buses up into the production schedule so that all 152 buses were all produced at one straight time. So that's an advantage to us and an advantage to the contractor.
Retiring some of our old buses that need to go bye-bye?
All buses are replacement buses. All buses being replaced are at least 15 years old.
Thank you.
Okay. Hearing no additional questions, I will adjourn the Finance Committee meeting. We will take a break. We have at 1 o'clock, it's a short break, that we are to return and convene as the board to take up the one item and go into Ms. Hines' Governance Committee. We will be in the boardroom at 1 o'clock. Eat quickly.